From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. You may have seen Texas billionaire T. Boone Pickens on TV recently. He amassed a fortune in the oil and gas industry, and now he's gaining a passionate following for his plan to use natural gas, wind, and solar power to wean the nation off foreign oil. But as Pickens lays out the details, some environmentalists are saying his plan may not be as green as they thought. From Kansas Public Radio, Peter Hancock reports.
Judging from the overflow crowd that poured into the meeting hall in Topeka to hear T. Boone Pickens speak yesterday, you might have thought they were waiting for a rock star, not an 80-year-old oil tycoon who came to talk about energy policy. About 400 people packed into the building, and hundreds more stood outside in the steamy afternoon heat to listen through loudspeakers. Kansas may have been an ideal starting point for what Pickens is calling his Windbelt Town Hall Meeting Tour. Controversy here over applications to build two new coal-fired power plants dragged the state legislature into gridlock earlier this year, pitting Republican leaders against Democratic Governor Kathleen Sebelius, who introduced Pickens.
One of the things about Kansas is even when the legislature is not in session, we are the third windiest state in the country. No question. And that's been demonstrated.
When Pickens started talking, he was quick to make clear that his plan is not about saving the environment.
Democrats up there in Washington, they wanted me so bad to say I was not for drilling. I said, no, I'm for drilling. And they said, well, but why don't we drill on what we have? I said, I'm ready to open up OCS, ANWR, Florida. I don't care.
As he outlined his plan and fielded questions from the audience, Pickens said the problem is that the U.S. can't produce enough oil to meet its needs long into the future, and relying on foreign oil threatens both the economy and national security. What America does have plenty of, he says, is natural gas. His plan is to use wind and other renewable sources to free up natural gas that's now used to run power plants, making it available as a fuel for transportation. That means convincing Detroit to make cars that run on natural gas. Joe Spees, who sells green energy equipment in suburban Kansas City, raises concerns about Pickens' plan.
I'm real skeptical about his motives because, you know, he's the largest single holder of natural gas properties in the country.
T. Boone Pickens calls his plan a bridge to the day when this country can wean itself from fossil fuels entirely, and he plans to continue holding town hall meetings through the fall in hopes of focusing public attention on the issue before the November elections. For NPR News, I'm Peter Hancock in Topeka.
It's often said that the cheapest and most painless way to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions is to use energy more efficiently. But there's a huge gap between what's theoretically possible and what happens in real life. That's a problem for more than a dozen states, which are now promising to make big and quick cuts in energy use. In our series on energy use, NPR's Richard Harris visited Vermont to see how that state saves energy. For today's final installment, he returns home to Maryland, a state that's hoping to slash electric use by 15% in the next 7 years.
To find out why there's such a huge gap between theory and practice, I turn to Michael Dworkin. He's been involved in one of the most sustained and successful state programs, Vermont's. Part of the reason, he says, is electricity is still pretty cheap.
Even high energy bills are typically only 2 to 4% of a household's discretionary income. You know, they're a third of what they spend on health care, they're a third of what they spend on the car, they're a quarter of what they spend on housing.
For example, a 15% cut in my electric bill would save me $24 a month, less than I spend on coffee. Prices are climbing as fossil fuels get more expensive, but Dworkin says it doesn't make sense to wait for the pain of higher bills.
Efficiency is by far the better choice.
I got some inkling into why people aren't jumping at chances to save energy and money by hanging out at my local hardware store. On Earth Day, the local utility was giving away compact fluorescent light bulbs, CFLs. The CFLs were also on the shelves for a heavily subsidized price. Harry Jaeger from Southern Maryland picked up an armful.
Why are you buying a bunch of bulbs today?
Because they're only 99 cents. And everyone says the CFLs are always expensive. So since they're 99 cents, we decided to go for a few.
Huh. How many do you have in your house right now?
None, which is why we're buying some.
Right. Where are you planning to put them?
I'm not sure yet. We'll figure out what burns out first in the house, and that's where we'll go.
This brief conversation revealed a lot about the challenges of promoting energy efficiency. First off, Jaeger had no idea he could have saved a lot on his electric bills even if he'd bought CFLs for $5 or $10 apiece. Each bulb saves $12 a year, assuming it's in a lamp that's on a lot. So even now, Jaeger is wasting money by waiting for his old bulbs to burn out. And if it's hard to get people to spend a few dollars on light bulbs, consider the challenge of getting them to spend hundreds or even thousands of dollars on insulation or energy-saving appliances. I talked about this conundrum with Malcolm Wolf. It's his job as the head of the Maryland Energy Administration to get the state to its ambitious goal.
We know that we can give people incentives to buy energy-efficient appliances, to make their building envelope more efficient, to reduce their consumption by putting in energy-efficient light bulbs and technologies.
But incentives like appliance rebates or subsidized light bulbs aren't going to get Maryland anywhere close to its 15% goal. And here's why. Even if people are willing to spend money up front to do their part for climate change, it's not obvious how to spend that money. Buy a new fridge? Maybe, maybe not. Put in new windows? Very pricey. Add insulation? Well, that's likely to pay off, but how quickly will you recoup that investment? Malcolm Wolf says Maryland hopes to overcome these problems by training thousands of people to become home energy contractors.
They can come in, they can tell me how to improve my house, and then they can actually do the work.
Conceptually, it makes a lot of sense, but is it really going to pay for me to spend $250 to $500 to have one of these guys come in and tell me that maybe I need another $500 worth of work or more to my house? I have no sense of whether that's ever going to pay for itself.
That's exactly the challenge, is these are investments that do make sense. They will reduce your bill. You will get your money back over a period of months and years.
You just have to take that on faith. There's no knowing what your potential savings are until you've spent the money to find out. And Wolf knows not everyone can afford to take that plunge.
And a lot of us are struggling to simply, you know, pay that month's bill and can't make the investments over the long term.
Maryland still has to figure out how to get people over that big financial hump, and that points to a deeper problem. Michael Dworkin from the Vermont Law School says it's not just individuals who have to think differently, so do state governments. What really worked in Vermont, he says, was the state created a system of financial incentives to make the program fly.
You have to give somebody a stake in the game. You need to have an institution that benefits by doing it well and that suffers by doing it badly.
Maybe with the right incentives, someone will invent new financial instruments that will make it easy for people to have home energy audits. And maybe they'll figure out how to stir most of Maryland's 5 million-plus residents to action, even though only about half of the U.S. population is really concerned about global warming. But so far, the state of Maryland isn't following Dworkin's advice. It's simply asked the local utilities to come up with energy conservation plans. The utilities have no financial stake in the success or failure of those plans. And, by the way, the plans as currently written don't get close to reaching the Maryland goals.
It makes sense to have a goal if you're willing to tie impacts to it and results and responsibility for it. Declaring a goal with no responsibility is a waste of time for everybody.
Dworkin says Vermont set realistic goals and it's meeting them. But the goals are much less ambitious than those set forth in Maryland, or California, New Jersey, New York, and Massachusetts, to name a few. Malcolm Wolf at the Maryland Energy Administration admits the state is trying to bite off a lot with its new law.
This is an aspirational goal. We want to achieve 15%. If we're successful, we think it's the same as avoiding three new power plants. We'll save the state almost $6 billion. Some outside groups have estimated that it'll create over 8,000 green-collar jobs. If, in fact, we fall a little short and we've only reduced consumption 12% and it only creates 7,000 jobs and avoids two power plants, I think that is a victory for consumers in Maryland.
The potential benefits are not just for consumers, of course. Michael Dworkin says successful conservation programs strike at the heart of climate change. Nationwide, electricity is responsible for 40% of carbon emissions.
Anything that saves on the electric front has a very direct effect on our carbon emissions. And as we look at the commitments that are being made in more than half the states right now for people to say, we will get our carbon emissions under control within a decade, What that really means is we will get our electric demand under control within a decade.
And success, unfortunately, is not just reaching a 15 or 20% reduction. If Maryland reaches its goal, for example, that only reduces carbon emissions by 4% overall, when you factor in trucks and cars, heating fuels, and population growth. Conservation may be the cheapest way to address climate change, but that's not to say it's easy. Richard Harris, NPR News.
To see if your state has a similar plan to reduce energy, pay a visit to npr.org. And now to Japan. The country promotes itself as one of the most energy-efficient places in the world. Its corporations proudly show off eco-friendly cars and gadgets. But as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, Japan's environmental record is not as clean as a Toyota Prius, and some critics are dismissing Japan's promotions.
Plug-in cars, recycled building materials, humanoid robots. These were just a few of the futuristic products that Honda, Toshiba, Hitachi, and others were promoting in their corporate booths and videos at the G8 summit in Hokkaido this month. The images were of a cool Japan, helping an overheated planet to chill out. At the Fujitsu booth, Miwako Morishima showed off her company's latest green gadgets.
Can you touch the,
It feels great. It's a wooden,
yes,
a wooden laptop computer.
Yeah, sure.
Called the Monica, is that right?
Yeah. It's not product yet. There's some more hurdle we have to overcome to deliver as a product.
The centerpiece of the show was the Zero Emission House, a prototype home with technology from a number of big Japanese companies. House guide Akiko Obayashi explained that the house gets most of its electricity from renewable sources.
At the moment, if the weather is good, we can provide all the electricity from the solar panels and also the wind turbine.
The house's walls include built-in seismic shock absorbers.
In Japan, we have a lot of earthquake, and it absorbs the shock and change to the heat.
Yes, but not enough to heat the house, right?
No, no.
Experts point out that many of the same Japanese companies that make these products actually oppose government measures to limit emissions, such as carbon trading systems. Iida Tetsunari is director of the Tokyo-based Institute for Sustainable Energy Policies.
Japanese company culture is typically more focused on the supply side or technology gimmick or technology solutions. The majority is very much against introducing so-called cap and trade or carbon tax.
Iida says that the Japanese government is deeply divided on how to tackle global warming. He and others say Japan's claim to be a world leader in energy efficiency is deceptive. Andrew DeWitt is an energy policy expert at Rikkyo University in Tokyo.
The establishment here says, oh, look, we're out in front of the Europeans. We're 20 years ahead of the Europeans. I mean, that's just on the face of it wrong.
He notes that Japan has set low targets for renewable energy use, and it has so far only urged companies to voluntarily reduce their carbon emissions. DeWitt says that at root, many Japanese corporations are suspicious of government intervention in the economy. They're reacting, he says, to the huge infrastructure spending and corruption that followed the busting of Japan's economic bubble.
They want to get away from these pork barrel projects, you know, the spending on roads and so forth. And that was very much emphasized in the 90s as an effort to prime the economic pump.
To lead the world, Japan must take the initiative by achieving a low-carbon society, Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda urged his cabinet. But if Japanese companies are left to set their own targets for energy efficiency, DeWitt says, they will not be leading the world's charge out of fossil fuels. They will be following it after all their other options and resources have been exhausted. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News.
Some states have adopted ambitious goals to cut energy use as an easy and inexpensive way to address climate change. Many of those plans call for steep and quick reductions in electricity use over just a few years. But it won't be easy to reach those goals. Vermont, for one, instituted an aggressive program 8 years ago, and it's finding just how challenging it is to save large amounts of energy on a statewide scale. NPR's Richard Harris traveled to Vermont for the second part of our series on energy conservation.
States are just coming to realize how much energy and how much money is simply wasted through inefficient use of electricity. But Vermont came to that realization a decade ago, and now it spends more than any other state, $46 per person per year, to eliminate that waste.
Efficiency is actually the cheapest resource we have to meet our electric service needs.
Blair Hamilton works at Efficiency Vermont. It's an extraordinary nonprofit company. It gets money from everyone who uses electricity in the state, and it uses that money to keep the lights on and the fridges humming, all while using less electricity. Hamilton thinks of it as a utility that supplies relief instead of electrons.
Our price happens to be a lot lower than those supply options.
Efficiency Vermont has been the company providing those savings for 8 years now. Blair Hamilton takes us out on the road to show us how it works. The program involves every category of user, residential, commercial, and industrial. The first stop is a small factory. Hazlett Strip Casting produces enormous machines that are used by sheet metal manufacturers.
Yeah, what you're entering here is our main shop. It's our main production area.
Facilities manager Alan Landry shows us around the cavernous room. It takes a lot of energy to run this factory. For example, the tools are powered with compressed air. But Efficiency Vermont engineers have been in and out of here a lot to help Landry find ways to use less electricity.
And when we went through this whole audit on compressed air and how much we use here in the shop, we really learned at that time that, you know, we weren't running these as efficiently as possible.
With the help of some cash from Efficiency Vermont, the company replaced its biggest and oldest air compressors with much more efficient models.
Right up ahead here is our new Solar 40-horse compressor, the green unit right on top of the mezzanine.
Next, the efficiency experts went after the old-style light fixtures.
There was 97 of them hanging throughout this main shop, which are large energy hogs.
Now most of the shop is brightly lit with super-efficient fluorescent bulbs. Landry says they not only save energy, they actually make it easier for people to see their work.
When you're struggling to do things on an everyday basis, shadows and everything, compared to what we have now, has been a lot of positive feedback. So,
what was your electric bill per month? Do you have any idea? Back before you started fiddling with this stuff?
I can tell you this. When this whole thing is done, we should decrease the electric bill about $3,500 a month. It's about a $42,000 a year savings.
The company recouped its investment in these changes in just 8 months. Energy Vermont kicked in $22,000 to make the project fly, in addition to all the staff time it spent helping to design and implement the plan. Blair Hamilton says that's money well spent because the local utility won't have to purchase as much pricey electricity now, and that holds down the inevitable rate increases for everyone in the state. So everyone wins.
Straight down through, we'll go down by the caster operation down there.
But it's no miracle. The full court press at this plant managed to reduce the electric use here by just 15%. So the lesson here is it often takes a lot of work to get a modest gain.
See you again. Have a good day, guys. See ya.
Leaving the factory, we head down the road to look at a store. Retail business is another major user of electricity.
Dick, up front, please.
We step through the front door of a large mom-and-pop grocery store. Hamilton points proudly to a display that's promoting heavily subsidized compact fluorescent light bulbs.
You gotta love it, huh? Here we are. Here's our Earthmates, and, you know.
99 cents a bulb.
Yep.
That's fantastic.
And you've got compliments of Earthmate Dick Mazza and Efficiency Vermont.
Dick Mazza would be the store's owner and a Vermont state senator. He comes out from the back room to greet us.
Yeah, we've been here a few years. 51.
51 years, is that right? Wow. And the lights don't look like they're 51 years old.
No, this is all new and different.
Mazza called Efficiency Vermont to see what his store could do to conserve energy. In addition to the lights, they suggested putting in a clever system in the back coolers that draws in cold air in the winter to reduce the cost of refrigeration. Mazda also got rid of the old open refrigerator cases.
They said it couldn't be done, but I went with closed case on meat with glass doors in front. I had over about 30 feet of open cases for meat, for produce, for deli, and it's much more efficient, and the product stays fresher longer.
How quickly did this pay back for you in terms of saved energy bills?
Well, that's a tough one to figure out. You know, rates increase all the time, so, you know, we haven't kept an accurate, but I know one thing, we haven't gone higher over the past 3 or 4 years. In fact, our energy bill last year was about, dollar-wise, I think within $100 difference.
It takes a pretty sophisticated customer to realize that he's actually saving money, even though his electric bill didn't go down. Efficiency Vermont uses these same principles to help consumers save energy as well. Home appliances with Federal Energy Star efficiency ratings cost more, but Blair Hamilton's outfit has found a successful strategy for getting people to buy them. They hand out generous rebates, and they also meet with the retailers and salespeople to entice them to sell the most efficient appliances.
Having the salespeople, when someone is looking at different washing machines, say, "This is the good one here," helps a lot.
The result has been impressive. Hamilton says two-thirds of all refrigerators, washing machines, and room air conditioners sold in the state are Energy Star models. That's at or near the best rate in the nation. And 8 years in, he says, you can see that the statewide effort has paid off.
If we look today at, say, that pie chart of how do Vermont's energy needs get met, and you've got one-third nuclear and one-third hydro, and the wedge for energy efficiency in terms of this year is about 7%.
That's a real dent. Unfortunately, energy demand has also been increasing year after year. So now, 8 years into this ambitious program, Vermont is actually consuming a bit more electricity than it was in the year 2000. So utilities need to buy as much electricity as ever. Efficiency Vermont hopes to improve on its success in the coming years, but the lesson here is a sobering one for states throughout the country. Many have much more ambitious energy conservation goals, but nothing as sophisticated as the Efficiency Vermont program to meet them. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Tomorrow, closing the gap between what a state would like to do and what it can do realistically to save energy.
In Washington, Democratic senators are calling for a perjury investigation into comments made by the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. The senators claim EPA Chief Stephen Johnson lied to Congress and folded under White House pressure on global warming policy. Late last winter, Johnson testified that he decided on his own to reject a California proposal that would regulate greenhouse gas emissions from cars. That doesn't match more recent testimony delivered by a former global warming specialist at the EPA. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Every now and then, the EPA lets states implement environmental rules that exceed federal standards. But when the state of California asked the EPA for a waiver that would allow it to start regulating carbon dioxide coming out of cars, EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson said no. Last January, Johnson told the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee how he came to that decision. Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island says the story went like this.
Administrator Johnson tried very hard to convince us that the California waiver was denied as the result of a process that involved him making a decision that was, to use his words repeatedly, mine and mine alone.
And Johnson said any contact with the White House on the matter was routine. But recently, a former EPA official who worked closely with Johnson told the Senate committee a very different version of that story. According to former EPA global warming specialist Jason Burnett, Johnson was about to say yes to California's request until he checked in with the White House.
The response was that the president had a policy preference for a single standard that would be inconsistent with granting the waiver.
According to Burnett, that's when EPA head Johnson overruled the unanimous recommendation of his staff and denied the waiver request. Now, Senator Whitehouse has asked the U.S. Attorney General to investigate whether Johnson lied when he told his version of the story to the Senate.
To investigate whether the administrator's testimony has broken federal laws against perjury, false statements, or obstruction of congressional proceedings.
Whitehouse made this statement at a press conference where he was joined by two of Johnson's most relentless critics from the Democratic Party, Senators Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota and Barbara Boxer of California. At recent hearings, Boxer charged that EPA Administrator Johnson helped the White House pull the teeth out of a report on potential global warming impacts against the advice of the EPA's own global warming scientists. Former EPA official Jason Burnett told the Senate that one of those teeth was a harsh assessment of public health problems caused by global warming.
Severe heat waves are projected to intensify in magnitude and duration over portions of the U.S. where these events already occur, with likely increases in mortality and morbidity, especially among the elderly, the young, and the frail.
The spokesman for EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson made it clear that he does not expect anything to come of the request for a perjury investigation. EPA spokesman Jonathan Schrader said, "I think Senator Boxer and her colleagues should leave reruns to the sitcoms." Johnson's record at the EPA is one of aggressive protection of environmental standards. Senator Boxer's record is one of press conferences and tirades. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
Every summer, an invasion overwhelms the tiny island of St. Lazaria off the southwest coast of Alaska. Swarms of seabirds descend to breed. For our series, Sounds Wild, we're going to descend into the middle of this mass of birds with biologist Michael Anderson. Anderson from the University of Kansas recorded two kinds of birds, the leach's storm petrel and the fork-tailed petrel.
It's nighttime, and so the birds are coming in and flying all about, upwards of 500,000 birds that we're talking about. These birds are actually digging burrows in the soft, moist soil in the forested areas, and so they're coming in through the forest, landing on the ground, and going underneath the ground, tunneling into their burrows to lay an egg. This nocturnal shift is sort of the changing of the guard where one bird comes back in and exchanges incubation duties while the other bird goes out to do some foraging. And they're making these vocalizations to help recognize one another individually in this sort of sea or mass of birds. There are two species here, and each gives a unique vocalization. The fork-tailed storm petrel has this one that just gives 3 to 5 grating notes, like a yap, 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 yap. And the leach's storm petrel is giving this more of a purring sound as they fly through the trees. Oftentimes they're crashing through the limbs of the trees, stumbling down to the ground, and then scurrying about, calling to their mate, trying to find their particular burrow. There are just so many of these birds that they can't help but flying into the microphone or the tripod, or even one time bird flew right into my head.
The purring and yapping sounds in our series are from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Thanks to NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce for tracking them down. If you'd like to see the animals and the birds in our series, visit npr.org.